Chapter 10 Paradise. Commodore Ferlant of the Ruhar Task Force defending the planet Gitanu was weary, and so were his ships. His little task force of ships had been on constant alert since the Kristang raids had begun. The crews were tired, and morale was low. There had been no opportunity for shore leave or leave of any kind for months. Worse than the tiredness of his crews was the wear and tear on his ships. They had not been able to perform proper maintenance since the two battle groups that had recaptured Gitanu had departed. In addition to ship components simply reaching the end of their useful lives, his ships had battle damage to fix. Shield generators had taken a beating, railgun magnets developed dead spots, maser cannon exciters overheated and developed microfractures, and jump drive coils fell increasingly out of sync with each other. Even the simple act of the other ships replenishing their missile magazines from the stores carried by the Commodore's cruiser was risky. With so few ships, the Commodore had tried a rotation where one ship jumped away to take systems offline for repairs. But while that ship was, for example, replacing reactor plating, it was vulnerable. So another ship had to jump away with it to provide protection. That left fewer ships to protect an entire planet, and for launch options for deploying those ships were limited. The enemy, meanwhile, could lurk far away and choose where and when to attack. In between attacks, the enemy ships could adhere to a proper maintenance cycle, although the Kristang were notorious for ignoring tasks they considered to be beneath the dignity of a warrior. The Kristang, the Commodore thought with a slight smile, would strip out a maser cannon if the beam showed any sign of backscatter, while they would ignore a critical fault in power management systems. More than once in the Commodore's career, he had seen Kristang ships rendered defenseless because a minor hit had caused some poorly maintained system inside the ship to fail. The Ruhar were always willing to remind the Kristang of the importance of proper maintenance, and that reminder came in the form of a railgun dart or missile ripping a crippled ship apart. Ferlant thought that the Kristang would have learned their lesson after they'd lost several dozen ships needlessly. But fortunately for the Ruhar, the Kristang warrior caste seemed immune to learning. So, the Commodore considered, did his own government seem immune to learning sometimes. After his small task force had been detached to defend Gitanu, he had complained with increasing vigor that he did not have enough ships to defend a backwater planet. Leaving a small force of ships had been a reasonable idea back when intelligence strongly indicated that the Theranin were pulling out of the area. The Theranin were not willing to risk any more ships for Gitanu. The Kristang could not afford to retake the planet on their own, and the Ruhar government was secretly negotiating to hand the planet back to the lizards anyway. Under those conditions, assigning only a handful of ships was reasonable, perhaps even excessive. Then the raids began. At first, the Commodore thought the raiders were one or two desperate ships that had been left behind when the Theranin pulled out of the area. His ships had destroyed a Kristang frigate during the second raid. Back then, the Commodore had been confident that he could handle the raiders. One or two ships without support would soon run out of missiles and their systems would break down. Then the raiders kept coming. His sensors so far had identified three frigates and a destroyer, and they must have support somewhere in the star system. Chasing gamma-ray bursts was not practical for the Commodore. By the time the light from a distant burst reached Gitanu, the enemy ships would have moved far away. So far, his ships had destroyed two enemy frigates with heavy damage to one of his own frigates. If this battle became a war of attrition, the Ruhar were likely to lose eventually. Gitanu did not have any defenses of its own. No missile batteries or maser cannons or railguns buried deep beneath the surface. No stealth hunter-killer satellites. No network of damping field satellites that could entrap a raiding ship. Gitanu had grain and farmers, and some pleasant, if dull, places to build a house and raise a family. If the Ruhar government intended to bargain away the planet below, the Commodore thought they should hurry the process along. It was bitter to think that his ships and crews were risking themselves only to drag out the negotiations in hopes of driving a better deal for the Ruhar, a deal that would provide no direct benefit for Ferlant's little task force, nor for the Ruhar residents of Gitanu, and certainly not for the hapless humans. Until there was a change in the situation, Commodore Ferlant saw his responsibility as defending the critical facilities of the northern continent named Tenturo, such as the cargo launcher, plus the few cities, military bases, and any place that contained enough supplies and infrastructure to be a tempting target to the Kristang. The planetary government had helped by emptying warehouses and dispersing their contents, so much that Ferlant thought with mild amusement, it must be driving the enemy commander crazy to have so few high-value targets on the surface. Maybe the government had done too good a job of reducing the number of targets on the planet. There had been no raid for 15 days. 15 days during which time the enemy was able to rest and bring their ships into optimum condition. 15 days during which Ferlant's ships had to remain on alert every minute. His force steadily grew weaker, while the enemy could build up their strength. The situation could not continue, so Commodore Ferlant had taken a calculated risk. Two of his destroyers were now in stealth, parked above the northern continent just higher than jump altitude. He had been jumping his other healthy ships in and out in hope that the enemy could lose track of his little force and not notice that two ships were not accounted for. The next time the enemy jumped in, Ferlant's two destroyers would link overlapping damping fields, preventing the enemy from jumping away. Below the pair of destroyers, the planet's gravity well would prevent a jump, and if enemy ships climbed out of the gravity well, they would become trapped by the damping field. The Commodore was counting on his plan to kill one, even two, enemy ships with limited risk to his own force. Such a triumph would make the Kristang think twice about challenging.
"Ship jumping in. Another,"
called an officer on the bridge of Ferlant's cruiser, Rue Gastallo.
"Frigate and a destroyer. We know these two."
Once again, "To seek glory in battle is glorious" appeared over Paradise in a burst of gamma radiation, this time accompanied by the familiar destroyer, "We are proud to honor Clan Subleader Rosh Atal Vergent, who inspires us every day." The captain and crew of the Glory were not happy. Crew members on the bridge shared knowing glances when they saw their captain's hand shook slightly. This was not supposed to be a mission for the Glory. Repairs to her critical jump drive coils were only half complete. The normal maintenance cycle had been cut short by an unexpected event. That event was the destruction of her brother frigate, "Every Day is a Good Day to Die in Battle." The honor of this raid was supposed to have gone to the Good Day, but as that ship had a very bad day, the Glory had been pulled back into service. Glory's drive coils were so badly out of alignment that she had been forced to reach Bredasus in 3 short jumps to minimize the inaccuracy of her jump navigation system. Even with the time-consuming precautions, Glory emerged 47,000 kilometers off course. Her crew noticed bitterly that her heavy escort, Vergent, was also off course, although that destroyer's drive coils had recently been calibrated. Even if the Glory had been where she was supposed to be, the Vergent was unforgivably not in position to protect the smaller ship. The Glory's crew understandably wondered whether the Vergent was out of position on purpose. As soon as the Glory's dazed navigation system determined the ship's position, the frigate spun on its tail and burned hard to get where she was supposed to be. Without waiting to get into the optimal position, the little ship fired her maser cannon in searing pulses at designated targets on the surface and launched a volley of missiles, 2 at a time. The Vergent proceeded to her assigned position more leisurely, taking a roundabout course that kept her further away from the planet so the destroyer could more quickly jump away if needed. The Glory had no such option. She emerged at too low an altitude, and her course was taking her even deeper into the planet's gravity well. One Ruhar frigate altered course to engage the Glory, while 2 other frigates accelerated toward the Vergent. The captain of the Vergent ordered the Glory to continue its assigned mission, while the destroyer would lure the pair of Ruhar frigates away. The cowardice of the destroyer's crew did not fool the Kristang frigate, but there was nothing they could do about it. As the heavier ship climbed rapidly to jump distance, the Glory shifted her aim to the single Ruhar frigate opposing her. Maser beams lanced out from both ships, impacting each other's shields. The 2 ships were too close to dodge speed of light weapons. The normal laws of space combat did not apply when the combatants were within 100,000 kilometers and closing rapidly. They flew past each other, neither able to change course fast enough, neither able to score a decisive hit. Both ships spun around to face each other, still drawing apart, their engines straining to cancel their velocity and bring them together again. Commodore Ferlant wondered at the actions of the Kristang frigate his sensor systems had designated Target Beta. They knew Beta well, as that frigate had participated in almost every raid. Based on the excess gamma radiation of that ship's clumsy jump-in, the Kristang frigate was not in good condition. Having survived a direct engagement with one of Ferlant's defenders, the enemy ship should now be climbing to jump altitude to escape. Instead, Target Beta had its engines burning at full power to bring it back above the northern continent. Why was Beta not attempting to escape? Did the enemy ship already know about the two Ruhar destroyers and stealth above it? No, Ferlant concluded. The enemy had not yet detected his trap, because the enemy destroyer, designated Target Delta, was still below jump altitude and moving leisurely to attack a pair of Ferlant's frigates. With a single word, Ferlant sprung his trap. First, his own cruiser, Rue Gastalo, performed a short jump in behind the enemy destroyer to flush that ship toward the stealth destroyers. The Gastalo's jump left large areas of the northern continent unguarded. That would be worth the opportunity to eliminate two enemy ships. Immediately after detecting Ferlant's cruiser, Target Delta had changed course, frantically climbing toward jump distance. And that is when the two Ruhar destroyers announced their presence by activating their damping fields. The pair of destroyers were close enough that their damping fields overlapped, making the fabric of space-time even more turbulent and increasing the effectiveness of the damping effect. The Vergent captain saw that he was trapped. Below him were a pair of enemy frigates, above were a pair of destroyers, and behind was a cruiser. The Vergent could not jump away and could not outfight five enemy ships, so she plunged forward and screamed for the Glory to protect her. The crew of the Glory almost could not believe what they heard, and asked for confirmation that the powerful destroyer wanted help from their worn-out little frigate. When they received confirmation, they asked one more time to force the Vergent's captain to scream at them over an open channel. The entire Ruhar task force heard, and soon so had the Kristang. With a shrug, the Glory's crew altered course to engage two rather than one enemy frigate. But the single enemy frigate also adjusted course, and soon the Glory would have to fight off three ships of her own size. The battle was chaos. Maser beams stabbed out, deflected by weakening shields. Railgun darts and missiles flew across the void. Masers shifted focus to knock darts off course and obliterate missiles, and it became a matter of how much maser fire a ship's shields could absorb before failing. The Glory was losing the battle, having become the focus of fire from all three frigates. The only reason she had survived so long was her clumsy navigation system threw off the aim of her opponents, which became less useful as the distances between the four frigates shrank. While the frigates had their own private battle, Rue Gastalo and the two Ruhar destroyers concentrated fire on Target Delta, the Vergent. Commodore Ferlant studied the Gastalo's main tactical display, running the view back to the beginning of the battle, then fast forward.
"Smith," he asked his executive officer, "do their tactics seem strange to you?"
The XO nodded.
"Yes, I was about to mention that. At first, I thought that destroyer was flying high cover for the frigate."
That frigate, that particular too-familiar ship that had been the bane of the Defense Task Force's existence since the raids began.
"They jumped in too far apart to support each other. The frigate's jump drive is badly out of sync, so that part could have been unintended. But when they began maneuvering, the destroyer moved independently. It did not alter course to protect the frigate. Also, the destroyer has not fired at the planet. The frigate has fired its maser cannon, but not any important target."
He indicated the areas struck by the frigate's maser.
"This uninhabited forest, it's not even agricultural land. If there were some sort of hidden target there that we can't see, they didn't even shoot at it long enough to make a difference. They shifted aim with every pulse. Sir, it appears that they want us to think this is a raid, but this time they don't want to cause any damage. And now the destroyer has been screaming for the frigate to protect it,"
Smith said the last with a raised eyebrow. The Kristang frigate was in poor condition. It was not capable of protecting its larger, more heavily protected companion. Ferlant zoomed the display out to view the entire situation around Gitanu.
"That frigate has been a pain in our backside for too long. But it has survived so long now, it would be almost a shame to kill it now. The destroyer is the more important target. Signal all ships to concentrate fire on the destroyer."
"Yes, sir," Smith acknowledged. "It will be some time before the Hertal can disengage,"
he cautioned, and pointed to the Ruhar frigate Mem-Hertal on the display.
She will pass the enemy frigate in a few minutes.
Very well. Let the Hertal keep target Beta busy. The other frigates will cut off target Delta's escape route.
His own cruiser, Gustalo, had been caught out of position when the Kristang jumped in, and likely would still be scrambling to change course when the battle ended. With four defending ships concentrating fire at a single enemy destroyer, and that ship being unable to form a jump wormhole, target Delta's life expectancy could now be measured in minutes.
Then we...
The main display zoomed out on its own, red lights flashing and warning horns blaring. Above the Gustalo, above minimum safe jump distance, 16 Kristang warships jumped in. The enhanced task force now included a battlecruiser and two cruisers of Gustalo's size. The additional ships had been dropped off at the edge of the star system by a Theranin star carrier 33 days before. The star carrier was not waiting for the Kristang ships to return, and indeed, the Kristang task force could not afford to have their ships brought home. Their mission to the planet they called Perdassus was one way, unless the Ruhar surrendered the world through negotiation. The additional Kristang ships had flown the slow way through normal space to the other side of the fourth planet and waited there, without the Ruhar even knowing new ships had arrived. With the raids occupying Commodore Ferlant's attention as the Kristang planned, Ferlant had been unable to properly patrol the star system. The Kristang ships fired one volley of railgun darts at a half-dozen high-value targets on the surface, then their weapons went silent. They did not even fire at the defending Ruhar ships. The arrival of the Kristang task force came too late for the worn-out Glory. The little frigate survived its second pass with the Ruhar frigate Mem-Hertal, but the Glory's shields were now down to only 22% effectiveness. The shield emitters were so polarized from deflecting maser fire that they needed to be taken offline and restarted. Her sensor field was so confused by the intense cloud of high-energy particles clinging to the ship's hull that the ship had lost track of an incoming missile. Her defensive maser and particle beam cannons were firing almost blindly, knowing that the ship's weakened shields could not protect the hull from even a near-miss warhead explosion. The missile raced in toward the enemy frigate, jinking randomly to avoid defensive fire. If the missile had known the enemy's weakness, it would have flown straight and true, right into the frigate's reactor. The arrival of the task force was perfectly timed for the Vergent. She had been attacked by four enemy ships and trapped, unable to climb to jump distance. Even if the pair of destroyers above had not blocked her access to jump altitude, the damping field those two ships projected would prevent the Vergent from jumping away. The Kristang destroyer was battered, maneuvering wildly to avoid maser and railgun fire, and her defensive batteries were smoking hot from exploding incoming missiles. Then suddenly, incoming fire stopped as the enemy ships broke contact and climbed frantically for jump altitude. The two Ruhar destroyers above Vergent turned off their power-draining damping fields and fed power to jump-drive capacitors and defensive shields, anticipating a hard fight with the powerful Kristang task force. A fight that never came. On the Vergent's bridge, her crew exulted, and her captain pumped his fist in the air triumphantly. He was about to order his ship's railgun turned to fire on a now-retreating enemy frigate when the task force commander ordered him to cease fire for the moment, and of all things, to use the Vergent's maser cannons to intercept the missile that threatened the "to seek glory in battle is glorious." At first, the Vergent's captain could not believe the order. It must have been scrambled in transmission or in the decryption process. He held his railgun fire anyway, wary of angering his commander. Then confirmation was received. The Glory's sensor field had lost track of an enemy missile, and the Vergent was the closest ship, the only ship capable of destroying the missile before it blew the little Glory into dust. The captain turned to his weapons officer.
"We are ordered to intercept a missile that is tracking the Glory. You will do your best to comply. However..."
The captain's lips curling in a grimace that was the Kristang equivalent of a smile.
"It is unfortunate that our own sensors have been degraded by recent action."
"Yes, Captain. Understood," the weaponeer acknowledged and turned his attention to the console in front of him. "Engaging maser cannons now."
The missile had its own problems, having to keep track of a target that was surrounded by a cloud of high-energy particles. Debris from other missile warheads cluttered orbital space, and the missile's brain was confused by overlapping sensor fields, only one of which was its own. The missile's sensor field distorted unpredictably, making it momentarily lose track of its target. It also detected defensive maser and particle cannon fire, and the missile jerked side to side violently to throw off the enemy's aim. A maser came close, this beam from a different direction. Alarmed, the missile's brain changed course and fired thrusters in an attempt to now escape two opponents.
"I am sorry, Captain," the weaponeer reported in a casual voice. "We are unable to effectively target the missile from this range. We risk hitting the Glory."
"That is unfortunate,"
the captain said, now bored. He still needed to make it look good for the task force commander.
"Continue trying, weaponeer."
The Ruhar missile regained a lock on its target, which it identified as a particular type of Kristang frigate. In fact, it was a specific frigate that was well known to the Ruhar Defense Force. That type of ship was thought by the Ruhar fleet to have a gap in sensor coverage just aft of amidships, so the missile altered course to approach from that angle. The missile fired thrusters, and its engine swung around to propel it almost sideways, flinging it across empty space, and right into a maser bolt from the Vergent.
"What?"
the captain of the destroyer shrieked.
"You idiot!"
"I'm sorry, Captain," the weaponeer cowered in his seat before his enraged captain. "It was an accident. The missile flew right into our maser beam."
The captain fumbled for his sidearm to shoot his traitorously incompetent weapons officer, but as his hand closed on the pistol, he thought better of it. A dead weapons officer would be difficult to explain. Instead, he would make the man's life miserable.
"Very well."
The captain's lip curled in a sneer, but he never finished the thought. While the attention of the Vergent's crew had been focused on the two Ruhar destroyers and pair of frigates, and then on the task force and, finally, the hapless Glory, they forgot about the single Ruhar cruiser. Forgetting about that ship was somewhat understandable in the heat of battle. The Ru Gestalo had only recently been able to complete her turn, and only now was the cruiser able to accelerate toward the Vergent. Her railgun, however, did not rely on its host ship's velocity or course. As the Gestalo reached the point where her velocity relative to the Vergent was zero, her railgun had pumped out six shots. Four of the darts flew onward and eventually would escape the star system and galaxy. The other two, one following close behind the other, hit the Vergent. The first was deflected by the destroyer's defensive energy shield, which then immediately collapsed from the strain. The second dart plunged through the subatomic particle cloud left by the first dart and punched through the Kristang destroyer's relatively light armor. The dart missed the reactor by mere centimeters, marauding through the Vergent's stern to bow to cause a tremendous explosion that ripped the ship's bow off. The crew in the bridge was instantly transformed into water vapor before simultaneously boiling and freezing in the vacuum of space. As the dart ripped through the ship, it created shrapnel, one piece of which flew backwards and ignited one of the Vergent's own missiles. The missile exploded in the launch tube, cooking off its warhead. The destroyer was torn in half, and chunks of its own debris tore through the reactor shielding, causing the reactor to lose containment and triggering a release of titanic energy from the ship's drive coils. In less than 0.02 of a second after the first railgun dart impacted her shields, the "We Are Proud to Honor Clan Subleader Rosh Atal Vergent, who inspires us every day," ceased to exist as an organized collection of molecules. In the space she had occupied, there was now an expanding glare of mesons and rapidly cooling exotic particles.
"Cease fire! Cease fire!"
Commodore Ferlant ordered. He had been too late to stop his own free-flying railgun darts and saw with satisfaction what they had done to target Delta.
"All ships, cease fire and proceed to rendezvous coordinate Alpha."
As he listened to the ships in his task force acknowledge his order, Ferlant reflected on the message he had received from the Kristang commander, a message he thought he would never hear from a Kristang. Admiral Jet Aubes Kakrondo, commander of the Kristang task force, could believe his own message even less than Commodore Ferlant had. The message had left such a bad, sour, cowardly taste in Kakrondo's mouth that he had been forced to lock himself in his quarters and practice saying the hated message word by word. When he had been unable to get through reciting the entire message, he
He had ordered the ship's AI to mimic Kikrondo's voice and record it for later transmission. The message, forced upon Admiral Kikrondo by his clan leaders, offered a truce with the Ruhar on Pardassus. The clan wished not to recapture the planet by force, but instead merely to give the clan a much stronger hand in negotiations. When Kikrondo had protested that such a cowardly act was unworthy of the warriors in his task force, he had been taken aside by three senior clan leaders. Rather than berating him for insubordination, they had commiserated with him at their being forced to negotiate with the disgusting Ruhar. They were negotiating, the clan leaders explained, because a forceful military action to retake Pardassus would result in destruction of Ruhar ships and widespread deaths among Ruhar on the planet. That would almost certainly provoke a strong response by the Ruhar fleet. The clan was too weak for a major campaign against the Ruhar, and other Kristang clans would be more likely to help the Ruhar than help a rival clan. The clan had barely been able to scrape together the funds to pay the Theranin to carry Kikrondo's task force to Pardassus. They could not afford to send any more ships. Thus, he needed to avoid becoming involved in a major fleet action with the Ruhar. Although it certainly felt cowardly and beneath the dignity of a warrior, a carefully restrained action would accomplish the clan's goals, whereas a typical Kristang slash-and-burn invasion would do the opposite in this case. After the meeting concluded, Admiral Kikrondo could understand the clan leaders' reasoning and see the long-range wisdom of their decisions. He also decided that he never wished to become a senior clan leader. It involved too much of a distasteful word called politics. When his task force ships jumped in, Kikrondo had waited crucial seconds after his ships fired one volley at surface targets that had been approved by the clan leadership. He was supposed to jump in, verify the tactical situation, fire one volley, and then transmit the message offering a ceasefire and safe passage for the Ruhar ships to escape. Instead, he had waited with the excuse that he was waiting for sensor data to give him a more complete view of the tactical situation. In reality, he had waited in the hope that the destroyer and frigate who had jumped in first as bait could score significant hits on enemy ships. Instead, the destroyer Vergent was now dead because of his delay, without substantial damage to the Ruhar ships. Kikrondo had ground his teeth at that setback. The Vergent's captain had been incompetent, and the task force was better off without him. But Kikrondo could have put another man in command of that destroyer. Now his task force was already depleted by one ship, without any damage to the enemy. Warily, the little frigate to seek glory in battle is glorious dipped closer to the planet in order to give a wide space for the Ruhar task force to climb out to jump distance. Seeking glory in battle was indeed glorious. But on that day, the ship's crew had enough of battle and simply wanted to survive the next 10 minutes. A ceasefire could break down at any moment, and the glory shields were unable to stop even a low-power maser at the moment. To prevent shield protectors from melting down and exploding, the glory's crew had been forced to take them offline and let them cool. Until the generators could go through the long process of being reactivated, the ship was essentially defenseless. Inside the ship, the crew held their breath until the last Ruhar ship, a cruiser, jumped away. Cheers rang throughout the ship. The Glory had survived another day, survived a very close call with the last-minute surprise assistance of the destroyer Vergent and that ship's valiant crew. It was not only a day they had survived, not only a battle. They had survived an entire campaign. The Kristang Task Force had established complete supremacy in the space surrounding Pardassus. The raids were over. Combat was over. They had sought glory in battle, and in retrospect, it had been glorious. And now, her crew fervently hoped, it would be some other ship's turn to seek glory. Negotiations for the formal ceasefire agreement took less than half a day. With the Kristang battle group in complete control of the planet, there was not much for the Ruhar government to do other than accept the terms offered. The terms were surprisingly generous, almost unprecedented. Commodore Ferlant's small task force would not be allowed within 11 light minutes of the planet, although eventually Ruhar civilian transport ships would be allowed into orbit. The Kristang would land troops and equipment in the northeast of the northern continent. That area had been fully evacuated before the Ruhar came back, reducing the disruption to the native population as the Kristang established their presence at abandoned Ruhar military bases. The ceasefire agreement also established a zone between the Kristang and the Ruhar areas where no aircraft could fly.
The agreement left open the ultimate status of the humans on the southern continent. While the ceasefire was in effect, either side was allowed to take action against the humans, and neither side could perform any form of assistance. Shortly after the formal agreement was signed, humans on Lemuria noticed the tractors and other equipment provided by the Ruhar suddenly stopped working. Calls to the Ruhar went unanswered until the government contacted UNFHQ to state that no additional equipment or materials would be coming from the Ruhar. Humans were on their own until the ultimate status of the planet had been decided, at which point humans would be screwed, one way or the other.